I'm Reverend June Nilsson, and I'm the Lutheran campus pastor at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And our topic today is Creativity in the Old Testament, a Look at Humor. I think people make a very bad mistake when they refer to the Old Testament as a book. Because the Old Testament is much more than a book, it's a lot of books. When you stop and think about it, let's just make a list. When you go to the Old Testament, what do you find? What are your possibilities?
What do you type for literature?
Well, I guess we can't make a list. We don't have anything to write. Oh yeah, excuse me. Seek and ye shall find. All right, what? Just jot off some of the things you
poetry.
Can find. Poetry. All right. It's a poetry book.
History
book. What else?
Prophetic words.
Prophetic. The prophets.
Short stories.
There are a lot of marvelous short stories.
Law.
It's a law book. That's true. It's the foundation for statistics. That's what I had thought about. Statistics. Hymn book. It's a hymn book. She's my timekeeper.
I used that extra 4 minutes this morning.
Oh, thank you.
That it's fast.
All right, now wait a minute. We said statistics. What else can you find?
Genealogies.
Genealogies. All right, what else?
You said hymn book. Someone said hymn book.
All right, it's a hymnal. Hymn book. Okay. What else?
Proverbs.
Myths.
Is that what you said? Myths.
Mysteries.
Biographies.
You know, you can find interior design. You know, you can find church architecture and carpentry in there.
How about pornography? That Song of Solomon's.
Now let's take a vote. How many of you think the Song of Solomon is pornographic literature? I'm sorry, dear, you have no support.
Violence.
We're not speaking now of Song of Solomon.
No.
All right. Violence.
J.
Warfare.
All right. This is part probably of the historical. But that's really true. There are segments in the Old Testament that really, I mean, give you measurements, literally, in terms of carpentry and building and design and the layout for. And you also can find in there
dietary.
Romance.
Right. And also, I'm going to put a little line and say male, female. Male-female relationship, love story, that sort of thing. It's also, of course, a book of theology, isn't it? nature of God, the story of relationship with God, what else?
That's where you run out of space, you better.
Theology is what you do to the book.
Theology is what you do to the book. Well, so is history, and so is, you know, any body of material, it seems to me, is open interpretation and classification and organization. And let's take a vote. How many of you think the Old Testament is not a book of theology? You lose. How about drama? Is played out before us, is it not? Lots of dramatic material in the Old Testament. A lot of characters, a lot of conflict situations. How many of you think of the Old Testament as a source of humor? Well, you lose.
That's a bummer.
See, it makes you laugh, doesn't it? How many of you think of it as a source for ecclesiastical fashions? You want to design a stole? You want to make an awl? You want to think through liturgical garments? How many of you think of it as a source for liturgy?
Yeah.
Or worship? How many of you think of it as a resource for oratory? For oratory. How many of you think of it as a resource for meditation?
Definitely.
How about the sound?
Should be Christian education there too.
All right, education.
Christian education. Another education too. But.
Yeah. Well, the Jews have gotten a lot out of it too.
Dogmatic statements.
Doctrine? Is yeah. that what you're saying? Boy, did you realize how much is in this? I mean, how many resources we really have? I can hardly get them all up here. We got doctrine. We got meditation. And we've got mediation. Mediation. In the Old Testament.
Got some psychology in it.
Psychology.
Adventure.
It's an adventure book, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When you read some of those stories in the Old Testament.
Parenting.
Pardon?
Parenting.
Family relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, we've about run out of space, and I imagine if we really sat here, we could even think up more things that are available to us in Old Testament literature than we've even got up here on the board. But I think the one that most often is not looked at is this one. How often do you say to a friend, gee, I stayed home last night and read the Bible and I was just roaring? It's one of the funniest nights I ever spent. People are so geared, you know, to come to the Bible with this intense religiosity. You know, it's such a heavy duty deal. To get out the Holy Word, the Holy Scriptures, you know. but that's part of what makes it holy. There is a holiness. a wholeness. In our capacity to get a good laugh at our own human nature, to get enough distance to be able to get a kick out of ourselves, you know, or to take some of the big giants and see how they get whittled down to size in some of the literature of the Old Testament. Now, when we in our contemporary society think of humor, what usually comes to mind to you when you think about humor?
Comedian.
A comedian, stand-up comedian. You go to Vegas and you catch the show, or you tune in Johnny Carson, and it's a routine, right? We think of a routine, one-liners. A good comedian generally has pretty precise timing. It's a lot of it. A lot of humor is in timing. That's kind of a contemporary sense. Or what else would you think about in terms of humor?
Clowns.
Jokes.
Slapstick. Sitcoms, according to some people.
Sitcoms and television. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's certainly all there. But it seems to me that humor also moves us into a much deeper level. Because it, well, I guess it gives us insight into human foibles and our kind of misconceived self-concepts. It reflects the ongoing presence of the Creator's inventive imagination that is within us. Humor takes imagination. You don't get the joke unless you're able to make the connections, right? Like, one person can be in a situation and can just think it's hilarious. And someone else can be in that situation and say, I don't think it's funny at all. I don't know what you're laughing about. You know? There is a joke. I can hardly tell it because I get it's just irrational. I don't know why. It just sets me off. And it's about these golfers. And they get out on the golf course. And one of them, it's a real intense playoff. And they get on the ninth hole. And one guy in the foursome has a heart attack. I mean, what's funny about that? I mean, that's a very serious situation. And so the other guy, who's his partner, doesn't want to interrupt the tournament. So he doesn't want to, you know, send for the rescue squad and all this stuff. And so they said, well, how'd you deal with it? And he says, well, it wasn't very convenient. He had to hit the ball, drag George, hit the ball, drag George. You know. Well, for some reason, I mean, that's awful. Isn't that really terrible? But it just cracks me up. I don't know why. I have this thing, hit the ball, drag, short. Dumb. It's just dumb. But it hits a button in me that makes me laugh. And yet other times people can tell a joke. And I'm just hard put to get the point. You know, I know it. And they just think it's absolutely hilarious. And I'm sitting there. Yeah. Well, this way. So all of us, somewhere in our life, in our own bizarre, twisted way, from whatever conditioning we come from, find within the fabric of our lives something that makes us laugh, something that strikes us funny. And in wit and humor and satire and playfulness, we open up new possibilities. Sometimes the most grievous situations suddenly fall into place, get a new focus, because we see some element that at first we didn't see that helps us to laugh about. I was with some of you, I imagine some of you here, were with Betsy and her Bad Things Happen to Good People. And I was sharing a situation when Jerome was in his first parish that maybe illustrates a little bit of this. There had been there was a wonderful family. This was in Tyler, Minnesota, an old Danish Danable. And there was the Danes have a great family spirit, you know. These were happy Danes, the Grundtvigians. And one of the daughters had long since moved away and was living out east, and she was probably in her early 40s, had no history of any problem, got up one morning and dropped dead. Bang. And so the brothers and sisters were notified, and they brought the body back from, I think she lived out in Washington, D.C. somewhere. And it was a large funeral and so on, and afterwards, why, Jerome and I went over to the house, and we came in the front door, and we heard all this laughter coming out of the kitchen. Just, you know, raucous laughter. And we walked out, and here, the whole family, mom and dad and the kids and everybody, they're all sitting in the kitchen. And the tears they're wiping are coming from all this, they have just been having a ball. And all of a sudden, when the stiff-necked person comes, you know, the man with the collar, they sober up. And there's this very kind of awesome, oh dear, oh, pastor, you must just be shocked. You must just think this is terrible. That here we've just buried our beloved sister, and we're all sitting here, you know, cracking up. And the mother, who was just the most marvelous woman, just a jewel, with her eyes shining, said, "You know, Pastor, it's the first time in 12 years that all the kids have been home, and we've sat around the table like this. And we're celebrating that we're still alive and in touch. And we've been sitting here just thinking about what a character she was and recounting all the things that she did throughout her lifetime that just make us laugh. I mean, she really was fun. She was great." And she said, "We've just been sitting here, and somehow it was not they were avoiding the reality or the grief in their loss, but they were, to put it in our theme for the summer, celebrating the feast of life and able to acknowledge that part of the relationship that was still a gift to them. You know, all the zany, crazy, nutty things that she did that fleshed her out and made her real and made her very human for them." So sometimes it's helpful to be able to laugh. It's one of my mother's favorite lines, you know. Every time I'd be just naughty as could be or in a terrible crisis, I can always remember my mother going to talk about characters. But she'd say, "Well, you might as well laugh about it," you know. And then we would. And it kind of broke the tension, and it opened up new space for us. New possibilities for us to be. Like all forms of humor, our Creator's humor has a quality of aggression. It has an element of surprise. The punchline, part of why it's funny, is because it catches you off guard. It throws you off balance. Just when humans are in all their glory, the father puts a banana peel under their feet, causes them to fall on their faces, and then history seems to be a farce to make us sad. The Old Testament God, like the eternal practical joker, remains hidden and distant, while we, like Charlie Chaplin, are called to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and start all over again. Here is the God who moves from beginning to end. He sustains life, he gives life, but he also takes life. His work is one of aggressive initiation. He says, and it is so. He sometimes exaggerates, or sometimes he brings into juxtaposition seemingly unrelated entities in order to force us into new life fields. The comic contradictions, the collisions of opposites that catapult us forward. The God pictured in the Old Testament is the God who animates dust, who moves in the mist, who shapes life in ways that are unintelligible to us. He eavesdrops in the garden. He permits us to be tricked. He tests us as he tested Job. He opens the sea for the Israelites, and he closes it over the Egyptians, both created by his own hand. He is now the hairy arm, and now the smooth. And we feebly reach out to touch, wondering which arm is really his. The comic contradiction. The flood, the rainbow. Bondage, deliverance. Death, life. You sinner, you are a saint. A collision of opposites. The Old Testament God of creation could almost appear to be sadistic, unfair, full of erratic behavior. He's a fleeting contact in a distant place. He's so brilliant that we can only get a glimpse of his backside. By the way, that strikes me funny too. It's like, what do they call those guys who go down the street in the car and drop their pants? Huh? They moon people. Well, here's our great God mooning old Moses. But enough of the backside. We would look into the eyes of God. Were it not for the entrance of Jesus and the Spirit, we could see ourselves as victims of a cosmic satire in which we absorb the brunt of the joke, death. But God the Creator pulls a surprise on us again, catches us off guard, enters into human existence. Oh, come on. You gotta be kidding. Huh? What's this? What is this? This is God? This baby? Surprise. And he's not a king. What is he? He's a Jewish carpenter? Come on, you gotta be kidding. I mean, this isn't for real. Here he goes again. The Word. In the beginning was said and called and separated the void, and form came into shape. Now the Word enters human experience, lives out the human contradictions, and points us in the Spirit to the matrix of the comedy, the church. Enter through the Lord Jesus, the door, the way, the truth, who enlarges our space and offers a passageway. You know, I don't look, this is a strange thing about my personal theology. I find Jesus hard to take. I really do. I see Jesus as confronting me with truth, calling me to the hard realities of the human condition. It is not to the Christ that I look when I am in need of compassion. I find Jesus tough, and I see him as threshold. I see him as the door, really. I see the cross as the door, the entryway that holds both realities in juxtaposition. Jesus is my threshold between the two realities of God's nature, the human and the divine. And it is in that tension. Were it not for the coming of the Spirit, I do not know if I could endure the shock of the Christ event. But he leads me back into relationship and communication with this distant Father who seems to be hard to locate except through this door, this threshold, this passageway. God, who aggressively initiates relationship, breaks into our existence in the form of this Jewish carpenter. And what does this Jewish carpenter do? He slips on the banana peel, falls flat in his face, takes the attending humility, rejection, emptiness, picks himself up, is lifted from the grave, dusted off, and where do we meet him again? Walking in the garden. And this time he does not eavesdrop on the edge like a sadistic, detached observer. He moves in the midst of us, reveals himself to us. He is the embodiment, the extension of the Old Testament creator power. God initiates new action, reverses the expected outcome, and ultimately renders death powerless. Now, when you think about it, that's really funny. The enemy is tipped over and reduced to human scale. And it's Jesus who gets the last laugh. Before Easter, you know, we were so in awe of death that we thought it could kill us. So these are some major components in humor. Sudden reversal of the expected outcome. God does that all the time. The collision of opposites. And the falling of the absolute, or the idol, from a position of power to a position of weakness. As we use these to form a theological premise about God's use of the comic, so we can use them as a better understanding for human interaction, particularly in Old Testament literature. There's a rather obscure story in Genesis. You know Joseph. Everybody knows Joseph, right? We all got him in the Sunday school books. Well, he's thrown into prison, you know. But now, what they don't tell you in the Sunday school books, you know, about Joseph, you know, your image of Joseph is that he got sold off and that he was, you know, a righteous, pure, fine, wonderful young fella. Well, see, what they don't tell you here is that's true. but he gets thrown into jail on a rape charge. Now, it's not his fault, and it isn't true, but he gets stuck in this rather complicated situation. You see, he goes in here, and the master's wife tries to seduce him. She's really got the hots for this guy. And she says, come on, come on. Let's fool around a little bit. Joe, no. No. I have been told that I can have access to everything in the household. I've been given permission, but this I won't do. This is wrong. I'm not going to do this. Well, one day he drops in over there, and all the servants are out, and she's got a clear shot. So she turns it on again, tries to seduce him. Once again, he is strong. But she grabs for him, gets a hold of this great robe, you know, that we hear so much about. And he runs out, and she's holding the robe. You might say the hero gets caught with his pants down. And enter the master, you see. And she's angry. She feels rejected. You know, all her beauty and charm and seductive wiles have been turned down. So here she's got the goods on him, literally. And she says that he came to her and tried to seduce her. Well, anyway, I mean, here's the, you know, she flutters the eyelashes and does her bit. And so it is believed, and Joseph is tossed, incarcerated. He's tossed into jail. Now, you know, I wonder if he ever looked back on that and laughed about it. You know, and thought, boy, I remember that fix I got into there. You know, and I went over there and she pulled that deal on me. Man, that was embarrassing. Here I ran out. I didn't have, you know, I was just here. And then she used that as evidence. And boy, that was really a mess. I really walked into something that time. And I think all of us know of situations where on the one hand, the appearance was this, but the fact of the matter was, the truth of the matter was this. But it was so difficult, that's why we have courts of law, you know, because people get into those kind of uncompromising situations where they're flabbergasted. And they don't know how to explain what in fact really happened. It's just very hard to do, you see. Well, Joseph in his multicolored robe always looks so angelic and pure. He'd always been designated as one delivered by God, but this time it goofed. At least at first glance. But there apparently was, after all, some purpose in Joseph getting into jail, as the story reads on. But part of what has a kind of humorous base here is that Joseph really had uncompromising standards of morality. And yet, the whole situation got twisted so that it looked like he was being very promiscuous and irresponsible. A comic contradiction that catapulted him into a new life field. But you don't always know when you're in the midst of such a situation what's really occurring. It's hard to read it. Even Joseph, the one who succeeds in everything he does because the Lord God is with him, even he is vulnerable and gets entangled in a web that sometimes makes you want to laugh and sometimes makes you want to cry. The noble and the righteous hero, wonderful Joseph, literally is caught with his pants down. It's a cruel misunderstanding, but when the master sees the evidence and hears the wife's accusations, he gets very angry. He goes to Joseph. There is no word to speak. Wham! He's arrested and dumped into prison, and that's it. At any rate, to pick up the story, after Joseph is incarcerated, if you look at the 40th chapter of Genesis, open up your Bibles. Now, we're going to need people to read this story. We need somebody to read the part of Joseph. Have we got a, somebody who'll read Joseph? Oh, come on. Do you want to be Joseph? Karen? Okay, Karen will be Joseph. Then we need a narrator. Can we read, have somebody that'll read the parts between, the narration parts? Bell ring? No? Okay, we got a narrator back there. We need the wine steward. Can somebody be the wine steward?
Okay.
Okay, we got a wine steward. And then we need the chief baker. Okay, we got a chief baker. All right. Now, before we start reading this, not that these people literally have this, but sometimes. So we don't have sets, we don't have costumes, we don't have makeup, we can't do the lighting and all this stuff. See, so you have to, in your mind, you have to kind of get into this thing. Now, in my mind's eye, and maybe this isn't where your mind's eye is going to go, but I see this wine steward as being built kind of like a twig, real lean and kind of willowy, and kind of bending over all the time to listen in. And then the chief baker, he's kind of a Pillsbury doughboy type. You know, he's short and flabby and open-faced and raisin-eyed. He's the kind of guy you like to punch in the stomach, you know? As he hears Joseph's account of the wine steward's fate, his mouth kind of widens into a big smile, you know, that kind of pastry kind, you know, that's kind of edged in frosting on those round cookies, you know, those sunshine cookies you get at the church suppers, you know. We're told that when the chief baker saw that Joseph's interpretation for the wine steward was favorable, then he decided that he'd risk his dream too. So now let's read this little drama as it unfolds here. Chapter 40. I think we begin now with quite a passage for the narrator. Would the narrator begin?
Sometime after this, the butler of the king of Egypt and his baker offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker, and he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he waited on them, and they continued for some time in custody. And one night they both dreamed, the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own meaning. When Joseph came to them in the morning and saw them, they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast?"
Oh, okay, Joseph. Sorry.
Joseph.
Oh, why do you look so worried today?
Whoops.
They said to him.
Better all have the same version. take it at verse 7, one more time.
So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in the master's house,
"Why are your faces downcast today?"
They said to him,
"Okay, come on.
We have had dreams.
We have had dreams. There is no one to interpret them."
And Joseph said to them,
"Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, I pray you."
So the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him,
In my dream, there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. As soon as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand.
Then Joseph said to him,
"This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly, when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you. Oh, remember me when it is well with you. And do me the kindness, I pray you, to make mention of me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon."
Okay, now, just wait a minute. You got some parallel construction about to happen. Just be in touch with this. Let's go on.
When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph,
"I also had a dream. There were 3 cake baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating out of the basket on my head."
And Joseph answered,
"This is its interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days.
Just a minute. What does he say before? He says, the 3 branches are 3 days. Go on.
Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from
you. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, right? Mm-hmm. Right? What does yours read?
Off your neck.
off
from
your neck.
You.
Off your neck from you.
And hang you on a tree.
And hang you on a tree.
And the birds will eat the flesh from you.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Go on.
On the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief butler and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief butler to his butlership, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him.
Okay. The genius here is the parallel construction in the dream accounts. Very cleverly, the writer builds toward the assumption, of course, that both stories are going to have a common resolution, right? See, the first guy ventures his dream, comes out swell. So that emboldens the second guy to share his. And he's sitting there, you know, his little pasty face, and his little doughboy tummy, and his big grin, you know. What? What is this? The steward has 3 branches. The baker has 3 baskets. Both wish to appease the king. The wine steward holds the king's cup and squeezes out fresh grape juice. The baker carries the bread basket filled with all kinds of baked goods for the king. Okay, so far so good. We're doing swell. But it gets even better. Joseph begins his interpretations to both of them with exactly the same phrase. This is what it means. The 3 branches are 3 days. This is what it means. The 3 baskets are 3 days. The parallel continues. In 3 days, the king will release you. Since he had finished the steward's line with pardon you and restore you to position, it's not hard to imagine the baker's saccharine smile melting down his puffy cheeks when he instead hears, and have your head cut off. Perhaps he thinks his senses have tricked him, that his ears heard wrong. But Joseph expands the dream by saying, then he'll hang your body on a pole and the birds will eat you. Now, isn't that like getting hit in the face with a pie? I mean, that'd knock you off your balance, wouldn't it? He wasn't looking for that punchline. We have the makings here for a very good slapstick vignette. People laugh at the clumsy, dull-witted fool who always ends up being the fall guy. It's a classic comic character. Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, prime examples, aren't they, when you get comic teams? When the fat guys bump their stomachs into the skinny guys, it's like a collision of opposites, isn't it? And it makes us laugh. It's as though we all want a safe place where we can kick the underdog around a little bit and have permission to laugh about it. Humor can also be a guise for releasing sublimated hostility. You might as well laugh about it. This, by the way, has been very effective with men and women. I hate to keep pulling that out, friends, but you know. A lot of times when we can't cope with sexual collisions, sometimes humor is very helpful, and sometimes it is a device for covering up buried hostile feelings so that we target and reduce. Women are put in their place, in other words, when we use good sexual jokes that really put the male one more time in the one-up position, you see. And we laugh, and it's funny, but it ain't funny. It really ain't funny. It really ain't. But it's a classic. It's a classic. In this story, there's a twinge of sadness, for indeed Joseph was right. The steward is restored to his position. The baker is executed just as forecast. The fool is hung, and the villain survives. Happens all the time. Having tasted the sweet wine of pardon, the steward promptly forgets Joseph. For 2 years, Joseph is left in prison. It's only when the steward sees it to his personal advantage that he calls attention to the matter before the king. The humor continues in its ironic twist. The irony being that the selfish ingrate unknowingly plays a major role in furthering God's plan for Joseph. There is a mockery of justice in the king's arbitrary decision to save one and execute the other, with the baker and the... Yet Yahweh turns that into a creative opening that eventually puts Joseph into power. When the king has a dream that no one can interpret, the steward, wishing to stay in his good graces, suddenly does remember Joseph's gift, and the king has him summoned immediately. Once Joseph has shown his wisdom, the king appoints him governor. Which leads us to another component of humor, and that is mistaken identity, the mask or the disguise. When Joseph's brother, now you remember that whole scene where he's sold off and so on. When Joseph's brothers, who sold him into slavery, appear before him asking for food, you remember now the famine, and they come back. Now he's governor. Now he's in a position of power. Okay? He could have really had an opportunity for revenge. He could have sent him home empty, or he even could have had their heads chopped off. But instead, he teases them, takes his time in disclosing his real identity, plays with them a little bit. He pretends to be very harsh, very accusing, and very angry. But in the depth of his heart, he is moved to such compassion and such tears that he has to leave in order to weep. but he's got a plan. Now the underdog is in the one-up position. So he tricks them. He befuddles them. For example, on the way home, at a place where they spend the night, one of the brothers opens his sack to feed the donkey. Now, he must have wondered if his eyes were giving him the right message. Because when he opens the sack, right on top of the sack, he finds all his money. It's been returned to him. So he calls to his other brothers. And they're really frightened. This doesn't make sense. Of course, see, they don't have the biggest piece of the puzzle, the centerpiece. And that is the governor's true identity. They haven't recognized, and they have probably forgotten the young Joseph's dream about them all bowing down before him. And they have long ago assumed that Joseph was dead. They're not looking for the dead among the living. Things are not as they appear to be. It's very much as an Easter morning in the garden, when Jesus is identified as the gardener. I mean, who would be looking for the dead among the living? There is the mask or the hidden identity. All the ingredients for the comic contradiction are here. The reversal of the expected outcome, the collision of opposites, the mistaken identity, aggressive initiative, mistrust of the senses, that's another comic ploy. You think you see, but you don't. You think you hear, but you don't. And people watching this, when your senses get, the wires get crossed, people laugh. It's funny. And finally, the fall of the all-powerful, harsh ruler who dissolves before them as he finally discloses his real relationship to them. That which could have been tragic becomes comic. All the relatives load up their wagons, they come to the land of plenty, and they live together forever and ever. Now we have focused on, during this hour, primarily here, on the character of Joseph, and just a little buried vignette. And the Old Testament's loaded with them. These little buried vignettes that if you pull them out and really look at them and understand the dynamics of what's going on, really give you a lot of insight. Stories and characters and puns are all there if you take the trouble to uncover them. But being aware of the resources and seeing the value of using them are two different things. Now, where you really can get some mileage out of this is when you look at your own situation, perhaps in your parish. Begin to spot where some of the comic principle applies within the family of God in the ministry that you're involved in. Now, we aren't going to have time. I would have liked to have taken about probably 10, 15 minutes for you to get into triads and look at that question. What within the framework of our own, let's say, congregational life, is there that would involve some of the principles of humor that maybe we have overlooked? That maybe sometimes we get so intense and get so invested and so close to the situation that we aren't able to see God working in the midst of us in a lot of very funny ways, really. And that which we interpret to be tragic and sad and insurmountable perhaps is just a matter of process and growth and evolvement and the coming together of opposites in order that we might be catapulted into new life fields. The Old Testament's really got a lot. But I hope today we got just a little taste of the comic contradiction of the threshold through Jesus that leads us, and that marvelous spirit that helps us to laugh.